Don't worry about it. There was another ranger. But anyhow, my first acquaintance with Joe came when one of the gunners, our chief warrant officer, came into my office and said, "Tim," he said, "I'd like to have you come in here. We have a slight problem and a very interesting thing going on with a rancher that lives out in the Sagshack." So I said, "Fine, let's go." So I came on in and I met Joe Zentner. And Joe Zentner's problem was very simple. He, being a rancher, had a problem with bears in his cattle. And of course, this was his income, and he hated bear food. So somewhere along the line, Joe had required a Durand weapon. And but what he was more interested in was how he could account for these bear. And his object was, he was seeking some advice on how to mount a 50 caliber machine gun on the top wing of his Piper J3. Well, you had to understand Joe's aspect about this thing. In the first place, the bear were killing his cattle, and he just couldn't put up with that. In the second place, Joe was probably the oldest student pilot in Alaska. Joe was a very capable pilot, but he never, as far as any of us knew, he never sat or finally passed his examinations to become a rated aviator. And as you drive out toward Sagshack today, when you come down the long hill and you pass the bridge, you see off to the right a structure that's almost gone. And if you look at it closely, you'll find it looks like a hangar, and it is. That is Joe Zentner's hangar. He kept his little J3 in there, and that roadway from the bridge toward the hill going out toward the side path, that was his runway. That was his airport. And that particular stretch of the road happened to be right in a good wind direction, so he didn't have too much of a problem. But anyhow, he said, "How would you guys tell me how I can mount a 50 caliber machine gun on the wing of my J3? And we finally, it took a long time, about 2 hours or so, we finally convinced Joe that 50 caliber on his J3 was just too much. It just wouldn't support it over any length of time. So I guess we finally satisfied him, because later on, after I was ordered back to California, I picked up, it was either Field and Stream or Outdoor Life magazine at the time, and it had this great article in there about this rancher in Kodiak who was having problems with state federal Fish and Wildlife was at the time, over killing bears with his airplane. Well, what he had done is he had found a way to mount that Durand rifle on this J3 airplane. And as you know, the Durand rifle has the capability of going into full automatic. So typically, World War I sort of thing, you know, he had this rifle mounted up there, and he had this wire down into the cockpit where he could pull it and make this thing go, the rifle fire, and he was actually strafing bear. And this is where he got afoul of the Fish and Wildlife people. They didn't think that was just the way to hunt bear. But I can tell you, they may not have known it But Joe was afterbear in many, many other ways. One year I hunted bear up toward Portage Bay, and he had a little blind shack out there that he said, "Say, why don't you guys just go out there and you can use it?" One of our party was after beaver hides, and the other three of us were after bear. And so we were out there, and the man that I hunted with for bear, I didn't know it, but he had been pretty well been beaten up in a motorcycle accident. So one day we were climbing over a mountain, and he happened to step in a hole, and a knee injury reoccurred. So this was about probably somewhere around 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we only had a couple of miles to go to get back to the cabin. And an extreme amount of courage in climbing over the hills and whatnot by this man. We finally arrived at the cabin something like 3 o'clock that morning. So that was the end of the hunt as far as he was concerned, except for one thing. A couple of days later, Joe came by just to check on us and see how we were doing. And Joe had a pack horse along. And he had an old army pack saddle. I don't know whether anybody knows what an old army pack saddle was. Well, it's a crude sort of thing. It's made of wood emblems of items that are crossed this way, and in the front and back of where the candle would be, and it has horizontal strength members that go this way. And beyond that, it's designed simply to tie packs onto. Absolutely not designed for riding. And this part of mine who had the knee injury decided he'd ride back with Joe. So after the hunt was over and he got back, he said, "I wish I had stayed." He said, "There was more pain to riding back in that saddle than there would have been to walking back with that knee." Or you can just imagine riding on the saddle of that sort. Joe thought it was great. He thought that was a ball. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they couldn't shoot you.
Yeah, that would have been when you were with the Navy still in the 50s.
Oh, yeah.
You mentioned the Seabees doing a lot of cleanup along the, you know, out along the chain and all that. Wasn't there a certain amount of cleaning up that your group did here as far as
one of the
guns and things?
One of the problems that we had, yes, and this came under the aspect of my office there while I was in it, was the fact that munitions were stored in the various islands. And there were some munitions that were either dropped or fired or whatnot. And they were at certain locations or simply just scattered around. And they were actually a very bad hazard as far as people walking around up here. And a great concern to everybody because they were just flat dangerous. Even here in Kodiak, there was a certain minor problem. It was not unusual to have some child, let's say 10, 12, or even up to 15 or 16, come in and say, "Hey, Mom, look what I got," and have either an unexploded grenade or a whole line belted machine gun bullets. These things were just a part of what was left over. And, but out in the chain, some of them were even worse. There were certain islands out there that we had actually off limits. People people weren't supposed to go on because of the hazard. And those were the things that the CBs went in and tried to clean up. Well, there were actually right here in Kodiak, there were three large magazine areas, but they were pretty well taken care of by the ordnance department. There were some problems. What we used to call the old Burma Road, now that was the one that goes up between Woman's Mountain and Pyramid. That's the road. Woman's Mountain and Barometer. When the Navy was here, we used that area to detonate and otherwise destroy ammunition of certain types. In the ordnance game or the ammunition game, ammunition is manufactured and controlled by lot numbers. And these lot numbers are continually monitored to the point where they become either unreliable or hazardous, at which time they're simply just destroyed. So the destruction of them requires a certain area that's isolated. And we used to use that area up there, what we call the Burma Road, to do that. And when the Navy left here in 72, before they left, they had to send in a special team to sweep that whole area through there to be sure that there was nothing left that was hazardous.
What about all the installations out along, say, Port Abercrombie, Chiniac, all those places, when were they all sort of decommissioned or shut down?
They were originally decommissioned at the time that the Army pulled out. See, those installations, the command post at Chiniac, Abercrombie, and the one at Boy Scout Lake, were actually Army installations. They were linked into a battery control of the guns that they had planted in various areas. For instance, there are two gun emplacements up from what is now BioDry, the horrible odoriferous things up there over the hill. You'll see an observation point if you go up toward Dead Man's Curve, where all that borrow is right now. That's an observation point. Coming toward town this way, there are two small gun emplacements and another observation point. If you were to go through Dead Man's Curve and about halfway, get off the road and walk up that hill up through there, you find some more observation points. And to the right of that is the command post. Now, compared with Chiniac and Abercrombie, it's a small command post. And that one was the one that the Navy sort of rehabilitated to use as an emergency command post if they needed. It didn't take much rehabilitation. Those places are extremely well built. Even if you go out to Chiniac, after all these years, you'll be amazed at just how well the paint has kept in those buildings. It's just amazing. But anyhow, I guess that's
fine. Well, how much equipment and stuff was left when they closed it? Did they leave things there, or did they pull it all out?
When the Army pulled out, they did a very good job of closing down their own fortifications. That, of course, constitutes, in many cases, just simply blow CVs at Abercrombie, that those big round circles, those are gun emplacements. They just simply just exploded them. Bill Buellen, that with the one at the Buskin River Inn, he got permission from, I think, somebody to bring one of those guns in from Chiniac, where the army had grown. And then he set it up there in a little mark. But anyhow, they did a pretty thorough job of cleaning things out. There were certain minor things left, such as foodstuffs and whatnot. Some first aid equipment and whatnot. But they were, for the person that didn't wander or didn't know where these places are, they are at times very hard to find. Those that are not sitting above ground where you can see them. Right out here by Boy Scout Lake, there are several, those that are underground. You could walk right by them and not even know they were there. Or if you do find the hole to crawl down through, you might say, gee, I don't know what's down there. I don't think I should do it, you know. But many of the places are extremely interesting. For instance, little known is the fact that around Buskin Lake, when we go out to Buskin Lake, we turn right and go up through the communication station. Originally, we could turn left and go up the other side of the lake. And on the other side of the lake, up there, over in the hill, is another magazine area. And very few people get there today because the road's washed out and you have to go through the lake to get there. And I think one time here, a couple of years ago, somebody was walking up that old road and looked up and found a bear walking in their direction, so they decided they better not go any further. So. You're talking about the Quonset at Chiniac? Oh, yeah. The Chiniac had a quite a large contingent of Army troops out there. Most of the old Quonsets are gone now, but you can still walk around out there and find the foundations. But when we were first here, all of those Quonsets were used as a recreation area, and they were under control of the Navy at the time. So they were assigned. You could sign up for a Quonset in this area and go out, and you could fix it up for whatever you wanted to do with it. And most of the people that were interested and did do it would sign up, and they'd go out on weekends or holidays. It was a second place to go, and was very interesting. They had a lot of fun out there, and they had a lot of amusing things that happened. Of course, one of the things that we know not to do, and that is to just don't leave food stuff and garbage around. Well. The bear were very smart, you know. The bear would, people would come out and then they'd leave all the trash and whatnot around, those that did. And then they would leave and go back to work on, let's say, Sunday night. And the bear would move in on Monday morning and finish all cleanup detail. The only trouble was that it was exciting was when several families would stay out there over Monday or Tuesday and run into the bear at the same time. There were never any problems, a few exciting moments. At the end of Owens Bay? Yeah, the end of Woman's Bay was a good example. When we first arrived here, there were Navy families living in Quonsets at the end of Woman's Bay. There were some very large warehouses out there, and they were open, and anyone could go in. I was a great wanderer at that time. I used to wander around up in that area, and I know I went into one of them, and from what I could ascertain, there was the complete woodwork for a chapel laying in out there. And then later on, after the families were moved out of there and the population of the base decreased, there was an incident where they had ordered a number of household appliances. I'm talking about washing machines and dryers and refrigerators and things of that sort. And they had never arrived, as far as anybody knew. So in those winters, we had a very heavy snowfall, particularly in 1955, 1956. The snow fell down and the buildings were old, and suddenly they found all the appliances. Whoever had been the receiving person at the time had simply received all the stuff and had moved it out in one of the warehouses and had it stored very neatly and very dutifully. And the only trouble was that whoever that person was got transferred, and nobody knew what he'd done. Until the snow bashed in the roof, and there they all were.
Yeah. Oh, there was one thing. When you were talking about the installation, the Air Force installation that you worked when you were with the contractor out there, how long was that operation? When did that?
I don't know exactly when they activated that place, but it wasn't closed down until about 64. It wasn't closed down for about 3 years then, and then the need for it as a tracking station had wasn't necessary anymore, so they had closed it down. It went into caretaker status for a while. Are you interested in what happened to it later on?
I just was curious whether
What happened to it later on was that it was sort of a caretaker status, and then as the transfer of the lands to the natives proceeded, it came under the Bureau of Land Management, and it is in an area that is now with the natives. And so under BLM, the natives thought that they could use it as some sort of a training facility. Well, the big problem was, I think, finances. It takes a considerable amount of money to maintain and operate those type of facilities. So that didn't really materialize. So then it came under the Department of Labor, I think, for a while. And they had a sort of a caretaker out here. And so then that finally folded, and it's just sitting up there right now. It's completely vandalized. Oh, yes, they were thinking about it. This was one of the ideas they had for using it for some sort of a correctional institution.
actually happens. What about the runway that's out at the end of Chiniac? How long did it take them to put that in there? Do you have any idea? I was probably
know.
Before you were here, but I mean
that was a World
was it
War
more
studio.
was it more of a runway than it is now?
Oh, that was a yeah, considerably.
I mean, that was one of those steel mesh things, wasn't it? At one time, whatever they called it.
Specifically known Marston mesh.
Marston mesh.
It was when we first came here, it was still in good shape. It was a nice alternate runway if somebody got in trouble. As a matter of fact, a lot of us, student pilots and private pilots, used to fly in and out of there. And when it was really a going outfit, it not only had the runway that you see, but if you were to wander around in the brush on either side of it, you'd find that they had quite extensive plane parking areas that are completely marshed and matted in there, particularly as you approach it toward the left of it. Toward the right of it, there were at least six pretty good-sized Qantas over there to house people, and one to house a power generation unit. But, of course, after a period of time, the Marston mat rusted and deteriorated. And, at the time of the earthquake, when the planes brought all of the people out there, it was a pretty awesome sight to see the planes landing on it. Planes would come in, and as they would be reduced in speed, the weight of the plane would cause a precursor wave of these Marston mat that are tied all together to just roll up in front of the planes all the time. But they all held together, and after the people had left and the need for the runway was almost over, one of the jobs that they laid on my company was to repair the railway. So they shipped in some brand new Marston mat, and we went down there and we put it all back together again. But I've flown into there since then, and I've of course driven by it, and it's in horrible shape. But those Marston mat runways require a good deal more preparation than most people think. They have to have a bed of certain aggregate under them, and they have to be built up and leveled off and drained properly, and then the Marston mat laid on top of it.
We've never gone into the ones in Chiniac. We always sort of drive around and sometimes find things, sometimes don't.
Tell me
about the island.
Which one?
The north of the bunkers that goes out there to Chiniac.
Chiniac? Where the generators were? Underground?
We went underground on the little island and we went up on the hill that we all went to.
Yeah, the one on the hill is pretty obvious. That's the one I was talking about. But if you have been to Chiniac and the end of the runway, there's a sort of a lagoon or a lake. And at the end of that, there's a small island. Now, that island can be approached on the same roads that take you into the command post. Except that as you approach the command post that's up on the hill, you peel off to the right and you go down the side toward the beach, and you'll find this little island down here. And originally, and of course before the tidal wave, this little island was connected by a small causeway, and you could drive along the causeway up onto the island And there are, I think, three quite large, probably maybe 30 by 50 feet of concrete buildings, structures down there that are completely earth covered. And these appear to be places where diesel generators were housed, because they have the stacks that would indicate that, the diffusion of exhaust smoke. Very interesting. It's covered now at high tide.
Yeah.
I mean the causeway. How is your beer doing? You joined?
Oh, I'm all set.
There's coffee
if you want. The one thing I wanted to ask you was a totally different subject. When you were involved with Sealand then, you were working for Sealand then during the reconstruction. What kind of, when did they build their present facility there with the cranes? Did that come in after the?
Let me start by this way. The present Pier 2 was the one that was constructed, and to my knowledge, it was constructed both with Sealand money and local funds. And it was constructed as a wharf or dock for not only Sealand but anyone else. At that time, a crane on it had not been considered. One of the reasons for this was that in the growth of Sealand at that time, they had a contract with the military to supply Korea and Vietnam. And in order to do this with no cranes anywhere, they had constructed cranes on the vessels. So that it was a very simple device. They put rails up both sides of the ship that they could drive this crane structure along, and then it had the boom and the equipment to pick up a van and set it out on the dock. So that the vessels that came into Kodiak at that time didn't need a crane, and they just simply put the vans on the chassis on the dock. One of the problems about Pier 2, there were two. Number one, it was fairly short. Number two, it is at from a ship handling point of view for a large ship, it is at an angle which makes approach difficult. However, this is not insurmountable and obviously not a problem that would prohibit the use of the pier. But in any case, the placement of a crane, as far as the company was concerned, became a necessity. So, first, as I understand it, they looked at Pier 2. And that, of course, brought up the idea of extending it. One of the ideas was to true it up a little bit more to the channel. And extend it was the other idea. So the information that I had was that they hired a company to investigate the feasibility of extending it into the slide area. That is, what they found, of course, was what one would surmise, that that old flight area has been dribbling rock for quite a number of years, so that there is a fairly extensive flow of rock from the base of that, that so deep that it would be prohibitive to drive piles into it to support it out. So that is the reason why they moved to Pier 3 on the outside of the site area. Of course, then also is the was the consideration that it might not be too good an idea to build a structure right below the, where all the rock was lying. So they moved on up to the other area, and they put the pier in there. They had there were several construction problems with that, but they were of a technical nature and corrected fairly soon after that. That's the history of Pier 2 and Pier 3 in a nutshell.
Here we had over 189 inches of snow.
Well, that was the other question I wanted to ask you. Now, you've been here 40 years?
Well, the first time we established residence here when we first came.
Yeah.
So, what can you tell me about how the weather has changed since you've been here? Have you noticed, I mean, what were your winters and what was it like?
Winters to now are mild compared to what they used to be.
You had lots of
snow. As far as the summers are concerned, they're pretty much the same. I can remember having snow in June. We would have the crab festival and we'd be down working in a booth and snow shower. That, of course, these were in June at that time.
Yeah. How did that kind of, that amount of snow in the winter, how did that affect your work, say, out along into Cheney? I imagine that pretty much drove things to a standstill.
Well, no. As far as the Navy was concerned, they had the equipment to keep the roads clear. At that time, the target range at the end of Woman's Bay, I don't know if you've been there or not.
I know it's there.
You know it's there. Well, of course, in training, keeping the proficiency of shooting up for troops, you have to train all the time. So they had big snow blowers, and they'd keep everything clear and open. The ski chalet, which they maintained, that was up past the end of Buskin Lake and going up that hill up there. They would keep all that area clear as far as the roads were concerned, right up to that. And this of course was great as far as the skiers were concerned and the shooters were concerned, and it was kind of tough on the ranchers over at Anton Lawson Bay, because they had cattle over there that couldn't get food to, and all sorts of problems.
And even though it was wonderful, we had that ski chalet, and they used to run buses up on the weekend. They'd run buses up several times a day because of all the people around the base, single person and otherwise, who had no transportation. They had the ski chalet, and they had a closet where they had skis and boots and gloves and poles and everything they needed.
Yeah, so that's what I wondered. The weather was, you had more snow in the winter to utilize that.
We did, but as far as the Navy was concerned, they had equipment to take care of it.
That was nice up there. And then in the spring, in the spring and the summer, just beyond the ski chalet, they had barns, and they had horses, riding horses. For the people to go out and ride the horses, all of them. They had trails all over the place.
The Navy really stretched, as far as personnel were concerned, That ski chalet up there, I would say, was probably a building about 40 feet wide and possibly 60 feet long. And it was an open structure. And in one end, it had just a huge fireplace. Yeah. And they had a minimal of, you know, cooking facilities up there. But they also had, at the end of Woman's Bay, where the Junior Chamber of Commerce folks are located now, there was apparently an experimental farm building set up out there. And they used that area as a golf driving range. And they used the buildings that were there. They would assign a naval personnel to that building to take care of that facility. Same thing with the ski chalet. They'd assign a naval personnel, and generally speaking, it would be a fairly senior petty officer with his family. So it was a nice arrangement, quarters for them, and they took care of the R&R facility for everybody. At the same time, they had a recreation area on a fog mat, and there were several cabins over there that they would sure they would close them down during the winter time, but then they would detail a couple senior people to go over and man them. Particularly during the fishing season and the hunting season.
Some of that, what you said, what's his name and his partner over there to open the restaurant, Dibble.
Oh, yeah, you're talking about Dibble and Conrad?
And the bear.
Yeah, they had some amusing funds over there. The two men that were sent over while we were here, they were two chief petty officers, and one of them was named Conrad. And the other one was named Dibble. And they were close friends. But they went over one year to activate the place. And they thought that they'd take a walk after a while. And so they were both armed with 270 rifles, 270 caliber, not in any way expecting a bear or anything else. So they started walking along away from this facility, and they had gone maybe about an hour or so, and they turned around and they saw this bear behind them. So they thought not a whole lot of it. They were pretty experienced outdoorsmen. So they walked on for a while and turned and looked again, and the bear was still there, only the bear was a little closer. So they went on for a while, and the bear kept getting closer and closer, right up the back trail. So finally they decided they apparently had better do something about this to see what the bear's intention was. So they came to a knoll that had no alders on it, and it was just bare. So they went over the crest of the knoll and lay down and watched the bear. And they let the bear come on in to about 50 yards, and they finally decided they'd have to kill the bear. So they did. Knowing that the fish and wildlife people, and those were the outfits that controlled the fish and wildlife people, required the hide. So they skinned the bear off and brought the hide back, and fish and wildlife biologist for the name of Will Troyer had the office down here at the time. So they brought this, and it was a big hide. So they brought it back, and Will took a look at it, and he said, "Boy," he said, "why didn't you bring the skull back?" So they said, "Well, we never thought about that. We just knew you had to have the hide." So they, Will said, "Well, you better go back and get that skull, because I think maybe you might have a record there."